This is an ABC podcast.
And so the ABC has turned 90. The Science Show is about to turn into our 48th year, so we've been around for over half that time. During those years, we've had many special series of programmes done by expert guests. And over last summer, we repeated three on music and its essential connections to maths and physics. They were presented by the late Professor Ian Johnston from the University of Sydney. And we asked you whether you'd like to hear the final three. And so we had many emails and fragrant letters saying, yes, please. So here we are, and just a note about that Department of Physics at Sydney. It's pretty famous, having been ruled brilliantly by the legendary Harry Messel way back. And only last month, its renowned Professor Anne Green was awarded the highest honour, the AC, for leadership for so long. Ian Johnston talked in the first three science shows about Pythagoras and his musical inspirations. Then on the family of Galileo, musicians all, and even Newton, that dour spirit. Never underestimate how music was an essential ingredient to their work, not an add-on. So let's go back to programme 4, made a while ago but containing so many of the essences of the ABC's 90 years. Cue Maestro, on with the show.
Now some more scientific entertainment from Dr. Ian Johnston. This is episode 4 of A Concord of Sweet Sounds, Over the Waves.
There's a dance routine that you often see used by well-disciplined chorus lines. On the stage of the Folies Bergère, or in the studios of a Busby Berkeley musical, the dancers will arrange themselves in a long, straight row. Then the one on the end starts off by doing something, kicking her leg or taking off his top hat, it doesn't matter what. A fraction of a beat later, the second one does it, and the next one, and the next, right down to the end of the line. To the audience, it looks as though a wave of legs or top hats is travelling across the stage, even though it's perfectly obvious that the dancers stay exactly where they are. You can see the same sort of effect in the waves on a beach. Whichever way the tide is going, the waves come in and break on the shore. On every beach in every country of the world, throughout the hundreds of millions of years the Earth has been in existence, it's been the same. The waves come in and never go out. Yet the oceans don't empty onto the land. Clearly, as with a chorus line, it's only the waves which travel and not the water itself. The idea that sound must also travel in some such fashion goes back at least to Roman times. One of Julius Caesar's military engineers, Marcus Vitruvius Pollio, wrote several works about the acoustics of the old Greek amphitheatres. And in one of these he said,
"Voice is a flowing breath of air which moves in an endless number of circular rounds, like the innumerably increasing circular waves which appear when a stone is thrown into still water. With no obstructions to interrupt them, the first wave of voice does not break up the second or the following waves, but they all reach the ears of the lowest and highest spectators without an echo. Hence, the ancient architects, following in the footsteps of nature, perfected the ascending rows of seats in theatres and made every voice uttered on the stage come with clearness and sweetness to the ears of the audience."
So far in this series, I've talked a lot about the physics of vibrations and what effect this has had on the theory of music. But I haven't said much about sound itself and how it travels, which clearly must have an effect on performance. To talk about this, I'll have to go back over some of the times and people I've mentioned before, and there are several historical threads I could follow. The first is mainly experimental, concerning the measurement of the speed of sound. Although so much of early post-medieval science was done in Italy, the speed of sound seems to have been a French preoccupation. The philosopher Pierre Gassendi, who was, among other things, the teacher of the playwright Molière, made the first recorded estimate in 1635. By timing the delay between when the flash from a distant gun was seen and when it was heard, he got a value of 478 metres a second. Mersenne repeated his measurements some years later and got the slightly different value of 450. But the strange thing is that the correct value was very close to 343. And why these two consummate experimentalists should have been wrong by nearly 50% remains a mystery to this day. Mind you, some of Mersenne's experiments sound a little strange to our ears.
Whoever wishes to measure the velocity of sound under various conditions, by night, by day, in valleys, in woods or mountains, either with or against the wind, in fair or rainy weather, in all these circumstances, experiment always leads to the same velocity of sound. The noise of a cannon covers 600 feet in a space of half a second. It is established from observation that a cannon ball takes 1 second to go 600 feet. Therefore, it follows that a soldier, hearing the firing of a gun at 600 feet, whose fire he has already seen, is easily able to dodge the shot. After he hears the sound, there remains half a second in which he can take 3 or 4 steps before the ball gets there. However, I would not advise anyone to try this experiment unless protected by armor of every kind, so as to be prepared for every eventuality.
Over the next century, experiments continued to be performed, sometimes in laboratories, but usually out of doors. And many a scientist was regarded with deep suspicion as he traveled around the country with a keg of gunpowder in his baggage. In 1738, a team from the Paris Academy achieved the remarkably accurate figure of just under 344 metres a second. You really have to admire the care with which they must have done that work. Very few physical measurements have stood the test of time as well as theirs. Now, all this is not without relevance to music. In the performance of church music particularly, it's often very obvious that a speed of 343 metres a second is not really all that fast. I sing occasionally in my local church choir. It's an ordinary-sized church, perhaps 50 metres long, with the organ at the back. And every time the choir tries to sing from the front of the church, we run into problems. You see, sound takes a sixth of a second to travel 50 metres. So, after each note has been played, the organist doesn't hear the singers respond until nearly a third of a second later. The temptation to slow down and let us catch up is very hard to resist. And more often than not, even the happiest carol turns into a funeral dirge. The same problems, multiplied 100-fold, face the conductors of big symphony orchestras performing in very large buildings. The one piece of music that all the books say gives enormous trouble in this regard is the Berlioz Te Deum. So I talked to a conductor who'd actually performed it, John Hopkins from the Sydney Symphony Orchestra.
Yes, well, this massive piece of Berlioz, really a song of praise, that's what a Te Deum is, we praise thee as the main essence of the text, was scored for very large forces, the concept being to perform it in a big cathedral with the orchestra at the opposite end of the cathedral, the orchestra and choir, I should say, or even choirs, because there is a children's choir where he's talked about 700 or 800 voices being in the children's choir, as well as a divided choir. And all that with the orchestra should be at one end and the organ should be at the other end of the cathedral. Well, I've performed this work a number of times, but always in a concert hall situation where the organ has been indeed behind all those forces of the orchestra and the choir. Okay. And so one doesn't have that same problem of relating the delays in time which were coming from the other end of the cathedral.
How would Berlioz have kept that in time?
Well, there were all sorts of references in books of those days to him having an electric metronome and various other things like this. The problem is that you have got an organ trying to play with a beat. First of all, the visibility is a problem, yes. Actually seeing the beat, and very often seeing it through a mirror, and the organ's a long way away. And then playing the organ chord, by the time it's received by the conductor's probably on the next beat, if not on the next bar. And so there's a great deal of difficulty in knowing exactly where the beat really is, because it's not where the conductor's intending it to be.
In fact, that work must actually sound different, depending on where you are in the cathedral.
Yes, the clever thing, of course, about that piece is that Berlioz put enough sort of space in the piece. It was very clever in this way that he didn't write trivially complicated music, that in these parts where the ensemble could be difficult, there's a certain directness about it, both rhythmically and also in the simplicity of the actual material being played by the various groups.
So obviously he's quite aware of what the problem is.
Yes, one of the amusing things about the score is that it's, after all, saying about these gigantic forces that he expected and so forth, there's a little note which says that, and if there's no organ, you can use a harmonium instead. So he's determined to get a performance.
Well, what do you like as the best environment for conducting?
The actual qualities that one's looking for, of course, are beautiful sound, good communication on the stage. That's a very important thing, yes, particularly with playing intricate modern music, because without that, you've got really an uphill battle, because players tend not to believe that they see and think of the sound around. Many difficulties exist from the front to the back of the orchestra, some say keeping the trombones up to the strings and that sort of thing. Yes. This happens down the line of a violin section, that the back tends to play with what it hears coming from the front or from the whole of the orchestra.
Rather than looking at the conductor. Yes.
Rather than being absolutely precise in that way. And this can create great problems in any ensemble situation. Communication is quite a difficult thing within an orchestra. And of course, today we know an awful lot more about that, and particularly acousticians know a great deal more about means of providing very good communication on stage.
I know they put those rings up.
Yes.
Above the orchestra to reflect the sound back. Have you any feeling for how long the delay can be before it starts messing things up?
Yes, well, there seems to be a critical point at which they operate the best. It's been loosely referred to as the 30-foot or 10-metre level.
10-metre level.
At the time when we were doing the early tests on the Melbourne Concert Hall at the Victorian Arts Centre, we tried a very interesting experiment of rehearsing part of the Verdi Requiem and moving this big array, which is some nearly 30 big discs, which are about 7 feet by 5 feet, and have this rim, convex surface on the outside, so you can imagine that a lot of energy has been reflected. And when we brought them down to what was below the normal level, the oppression on the orchestra was incredible. Players started throwing at the hands when they heard the brass open up, and because it was painful. So there's a potency in those reflectors.
If I may return to my main theme, there is a second historical thread in my story which follows the development of the theory of wave motion. When Vitruvius's writings were rediscovered in the 15th century, his idea that sound was a wave-like motion of the air wasn't accepted at first. Francis Bacon wrote,
"The collision or thrusting of the air, which the ancients will have to be the cause of sound, is merely a term of ignorance and of superficial contemplation. In sound, there is no distinct apprehension of any kind of motion. It does not visibly agitate the flame of a candle, or a feather, or any light floating substance by which the slightest motions of the air are betrayed."
The German Jesuit, Athanasius Kircher, who wrote a lot about music and architecture, was the first to try in 1650 the experiment of ringing a bell inside a vacuum. He concluded that sound would travel, whether there was air present or not. Another example of an otherwise impeccable experimenter getting the wrong result. But 10 years later, the English scientist Robert Boyle criticised Kircher's methods, arguing that sound must have travelled through the sides of his container. So he repeated his experiment in front of the Royal Society.
"We suspended in the vacuum receiver a watch with a good alarum, which was purposely so set that it might give us time to attach the receiver very carefully, exhaust it very diligently, and settle ourselves in a silent and attentive posture. We employed a receiver that was made all of one piece of glass, being furnished only with a glass button to which a string might be tied. We hung the watch not by its chain, but by a very slender thread fastened to the glass button. We silently expected the time when the alarum should begin to ring, and was satisfied that we heard the watch not at all. Only when ordering some air to be let in did we, by the help of attention, begin to hear the alarm.
Once this had been established, a great burst of experimentation went on in laboratories all over Europe. And most of the physical properties that we now know to be associated with wave motion were thoroughly documented. These included the way sound waves reflect from solid walls to produce echoes, the way in a closed room repeated reflections from many walls produce reverberation, and the way in which, when waves reach soft surfaces like curtains or carpets, the energy is absorbed. But there's another, less obvious property of waves which was discovered at that time by the Italian Francesco Grimaldi, the effect to which he gave the name diffraction. This is the ability of a wave to bend around corners without casting a shadow, just as sea waves will wash around a jetty or a rock platform. Grimaldi recognized that it only occurred if the spacing between successive waves, which we call the wavelength, was large. Sound, of course, obviously bends around corners, doorways, windows, particularly the low frequencies. So that was even more proof that sound was a kind of wave. I'd like to interrupt here with something that's a bit of a hobby horse of mine. I actually teach this stuff to music students, and every now and then someone asks, what do I need to know all this for? Well, I believe that good musicians, composers particularly, have a deep intuitive understanding of sound and how it behaves, which makes sense. It is, after all, their stock in trade. And you can tell this by listening to how they use sound to paint oral pictures. On a very simple level, in this chorus from Dido and Aeneas, called In Our Deep-Vaulted Cell, Purcell is clearly using the echo to give the impression of being in a deep-vaulted cell. Likewise, listen to the way Benjamin Britten suggests the way sound reverberates inside a stone church. There are all sorts of other effects, more subtle than these and usually rather more subjective. Sometimes a piece of music which progressively brings in higher and higher instruments will give you the feeling of opening out. Your ear subconsciously recognizes that's the way ordinary sound diffracts through a half-open door. Likewise, a piece which ends on a series of falling pitches will often seem to be going away from you. Now, don't get me wrong here. I'm not saying that these composers must necessarily know what diffraction is. The point I am making is that they clearly know a lot about sound, and who cares whether or not they know the scientific jargon. But students have to develop this understanding for themselves, and I think physics can help them. But I'm also interested in whether or not other people agree with me. John Hopkins again.
Yes, I think it's important to teach students exactly how the sound is produced from their instruments or from most musical instruments. I think this is an important consideration to understand what the nature of sound is from that instrument. I think there's a limit to how much one should teach. It's important to know something about the general physics of acoustics. Mm. But the further one goes in one's profession, of course, the more specialised one becomes. I'm a great believer in turning to the experts, and I have some very good friends who are some of the world's finest acousticians. And I found that what they can tell me about their side of it adds very well to my specialist musical knowledge.
To return once again to my main theme, there now appears in my story another of those towering figures from the history of science, of whom there seem to have been so many in the 17th century. This was Christian Huygens, who was born in Holland in 1629 and in early life took up a career as an astronomer. At that time, the Dutch led the world in the manufacture of optical instruments, and the experience he gained in his brother's workshop enabled the young Christian to construct the most advanced telescope of his day, almost twice as long as Galileo's. With its aid, he made a series of spectacular discoveries: the rings of Saturn and its giant moon, which he named Titan, the surface markings on Mars, which he thought were seas, and the strange celestial object which we now know as the Great Nebula in the constellation of Orion. He also made the first ever reasonable estimate of the distance to the nearest stars. His work demanded many specialized instruments, including something to measure time accurately. He was the one who put Galileo's studies of pendulums to work, 10 years after the old man's death, and produced the first ever pendulum clock. As a result, he gained a solid reputation throughout Europe. He spent many years as a scholar in the court of Louis XIV, and in 1665 he was a foundation member of the English Royal Society. But he was a theoretician as well as an experimenter, and his great interest was in wave motion. And this was where he came into conflict with Isaac Newton. It's here that the third historical thread can be taken up, a story which runs parallel to the understanding of the nature of sound, namely that of the nature of light. Newton had made the study of optics a major part of his life's work, and he held that light and sound were fundamentally different in the way they travelled. Sound bent round corners, so was clearly a wave, but light did not. He firmly believed that the only thing which would travel in absolutely straight lines and throw sharp shadows, the way light did, was a stream of particles. Huygens, however, didn't agree, and he spent his last years proving that, if only the wavelengths were small enough, waves could travel in straight lines and obey the ordinary laws of optics. But he lost that battle, at least in his lifetime. He died in 1695, widely respected and admired, but in the minority of scientific opinion so far as the nature of light was concerned. For nearly a century, Newton's views reigned. But in 1803, an English physician named Thomas Young changed the picture. Young was a brilliant scholar with cultivated tastes, though not very successful as a medical man. Those who knew him said he definitely did not have a good bedside manner. He also liked playing the bagpipes. I don't know if the two are related. However, he did a lot of research into human sight and hearing, and he became interested in a wave effect which Sauveur had explained many years earlier. It's the effect you hear when you sound together two frequencies which are very close to one another, which we call beats, like this. Young wondered whether, if light were a wave, he might detect something similar. So he shone a light beam through two extremely narrowly spaced openings and observed that when the two beams came together again, they produced a striped pattern of light and darkness, obviously similar in some fundamental way to audible beats. So with one simple experiment, the question was settled. Light really was a wave, after all. This discovery had an enormously liberating effect on the study of optics. Throughout the whole of the 19th century, all sorts of new optical instruments were invented. Cameras, spectroscopes, special kinds of microscopes, polarimeters. But one fundamental problem remained unsolved: to get an accurate value for the speed at which light travelled. I'll come back to that later. Strangely, while optics was blossoming, acoustics stagnated. For some reason, it was seen as old-fashioned, and there were other, more glamorous new research fields to tempt bright young graduates. As a result, very little of fundamental importance in wave acoustics was discovered for nearly a century. And that was a shame, because all the basic understanding was there to open up the science we now call architectural acoustics. Yet it wasn't until the 1890s that that work was finally done in America. The man who was almost single-handedly responsible for this field of knowledge was Wallace Clement Sabine. He was born in 1863 in the Midwestern state of Ohio and had an unexceptional academic career at Harvard University until a lucky circumstance occurred. In 1895, the university opened a prestigious new auditorium, which, however, had one grave drawback. The reverberation inside was so bad that students had difficulty understanding what their lecturers were saying. Somehow or other, Sabine was landed with the job of doing something about it. He quickly discovered that the architectural design practice for such halls was a curious mixture of traditional wisdom and hit and miss. So he began a long series of experiments to build up a body of knowledge from scratch. One of his favourite techniques was to put cushions made from different materials on all the seats in the hall to test their absorbing properties. But, since the hall had to be used for classes despite the reverberation, and since the only time it was quiet enough to take sound measurements was during the night, he had to do all his work between midnight and 5 a.m. And for over 2 years, he and two laboratory assistants had to move 400 cushions into the hall every evening and out again in the mornings. He never did manage to make that particular hall more than barely adequate. But his research became known, and within a few years he was called in as a consultant for a projected new symphony hall in the city of Boston. It was during the design of this building that his most important theoretical work was done. The Boston Symphony Hall was opened in 1900 and received a stony reception in musical circles. Typical of the reaction was this comment by a widely respected music critic in one of the city's leading newspapers.
Like many essays on musical subjects by scientists, it arrives at conclusions with which musicians find it difficult to agree. We have not yet met the musician who did not call the Symphony Hall a bad hall for music.
Sabine was clearly devastated by this reception, and he withdrew back into the academic world and devoted himself to teaching, emerging only when asked to advise on infrequent architectural projects. He died in 1919. The irony was that he'd been right all along and the music critics wrong. So far as I can judge, most informed opinion today regards the Boston Symphony Hall acoustically as the best in the Western Hemisphere and, for its size, one of the best in the world. There's a lesson there somewhere. Sabine's single most important contribution was his recognition of what we now call reverberation time. I'm in a lecture theatre here, which can hold maybe 200 students, though it's empty now. It's got hard, reflecting walls, so any sound I make bounces off those walls many times before its energy is absorbed completely. But it's a big room, so the waves have to travel quite a distance while making all those reflections. And you can notice that it takes time for the sound level to build up at the start of each word I speak, and more importantly, to die away at the end. Let me show you more clearly. I'm going to fire a starting pistol, and I want you to listen to how long the sound stays round. Now, because that sound is over so quickly, most people have no idea how complex it actually is. How many different components go to make it up. So if we replay that pistol shot at 1/16th of real speed, you'll get a better idea. The time it takes for a sound in some room to die away by a certain fixed amount is known as the reverberation time. In that lecture theatre, it was something just over a second. It's found experimentally that this time doesn't depend on the sound source at all, but only on the hall itself, particularly on its size and the amount of absorbing material inside it. This piece of insight is what we remember Wallace Sabine for most of all. The whole subject of architectural acoustics has changed since Sabine's day, but sometimes I'm not sure that it's really progressed all that much. A friend of mine, Ferg Fricke, lectures in architectural science at my university, and I asked him if, even today, there are agreed-upon criteria for what makes a hall acoustically good.
Well, there are a lot of disputed recommendations about this, but there are some criteria that are around, and obviously Sabin was the instigator of these, coming up with reverberation time, but he also came up with other criteria, which are very important. When he was involved in the design of the Boston Symphony Hall, he made sure that the hall was very quiet, and he surrounded the actual auditorium with other rooms, such as foyers and practice rooms and so on, so that the foyer itself was shielded from traffic noise from outside. That point about having very quiet conditions in auditoria is probably as important as the reverberation time, but they would be, I guess, the two main ones. People have gone overboard about the quietness, and perhaps I can illustrate that with a little story. Sir Thomas Beecham was about to conduct a concert in a concert hall in Europe, and the manager was very proud of this new hall and told Sir Thomas it had perfect acoustics. You could hear a pin drop anywhere in the auditorium if you were standing on the rostrum. And Sir Thomas, in his sort of inimitable style, said, "But I don't want to hear a pin drop anywhere in the auditorium," which is fair enough, but it is an important criteria, nevertheless, that the hall is quiet.
You don't want echoes, though.
You don't want echoes. That's a very important thing to avoid. There have been halls that have had echoes in them. The Albert Hall in London, for instance, when it opened, was found to have an echo, and this was because it had a domed ceiling, and the dome focused the sound, and because the sound had to travel many metres to the dome ceiling and then come back to the audience, it meant that it came back as a focus sound very late and was heard as a distinct repeat of the original sound.
How can you fix that sort of thing?
Well, in the case of the Albert Hall in London, it was fixed by putting clouds in the dome, reflectors that reflect the sound down to the audience before it reaches the dome itself, and any sound that does get up to the dome itself is re-reflected by the tops of the reflectors, and so the whole sound becomes much more diffuse.
You hear a lot these days that you need to have reflections from the side walls.
Yes. That is somewhat of a current fad. It fits in well with requiring diffuse sound field. In other words, the conditions throughout the auditorium are pretty uniform. I don't believe in lateral reflections, as they're called, the side wall reflections. I don't think they're necessary. Some people, though, think they're necessary to get the spatial impression in the hall.
What are the good halls in the world?
The main study that I know of was done by Baranek back in about 1960 when he travelled North America and Europe and asked musicians, conductors, music critics about their attitudes to various halls. And during this process, he found that Boston Symphony Hall was considered the best hall for classical music in North America and Europe. The Music of Ransal in Vienna was also considered very highly. The Concertgebouw in Amsterdam was another highly considered hall. All these halls are what we call shoebox-shaped halls. They're basically rectangular halls.
They'd give you side echoes, in fact.
They give side reflections, sure. There are halls that don't give you side echoes. And, for instance, Wagner's theatre in Bayreuth has funny wing walls along the side of it. It's designed not to give you side wall reflections. There are also fan-shaped halls that won't give you side wall reflections either. And one of the halls most highly rated in Baranek's study was the Tanglewood Music Shed in Lenox, Massachusetts. And that's
the what?
The Tanglewood Music Shed. It's a huge auditorium, a massive thing. I think it seats about 6,000 people. It's got a very low ceiling, which is bad acoustically by most people's standards, and it's a fan-shaped hall, which also means it should be bad. But it's rated very highly. Mm.
Do people agree?
No, no. Again, to give you an example, I teach music students, and each year I ask them to rate a number of halls that they're familiar with, like the concert hall in the Sydney Opera House and the Great Hall at Sydney University and halls like that that they've all experienced. And I ask them to rate on a subjective scale from 1 to 7, and on occasions I have got ratings from 1 to 7 for the same hall.
Why do you think this is?
Most people growing up listening to music now, say in Melbourne, will listen to it in the Melbourne Concert Hall. Most people growing up in Sydney will listen to it in the Opera House Concert Hall. And I presume that if you brought people from Melbourne who'd grown up listening to music in the Melbourne Concert Hall to Sydney, they probably wouldn't like the Opera House, and vice versa.
In the end, it probably is just learning.
Part of it is learning, yeah. And that's the basis for much acoustical design. If you listen to any acoustic consultant talking about how they fine-tune a hall, they won't actually tell you what they're doing. I guess it's a euphemism, really, for getting the audience and the musicians used to the hall. Once the hall is built, there is very little you can do to change the acoustics.
It would seem then to be something of an open question as to whether architectural acoustics, as it is practiced, should be classed as a science or an art form. But nevertheless, the kind of work that Sabine did was a significant landmark in our increasing acoustical understanding of music. Clearly, of all the properties of sound waves that I've talked about, the one that must be most important for music is reverberation time. You see, most musical performances take place inside rooms, and so every note you play, every syllable you utter will be heard by the audience for this length of time after you've stopped making it. And if this time is long, then all the separate sounds are going to run into one another. With that realization, if you think about it, it becomes clear that music itself must have been changed by the kind of rooms it was played in. Start with the old Gothic cathedrals. They were enormous buildings. Some of them had volumes of over 100,000 cubic metres. And they were made of hard, reflective stone. They often had reverberation times of 7 or 8 seconds. In the big cathedral at Cologne, it's supposed to be 13 seconds. Furthermore, the stone was often rough cut, so it tended to absorb better at high frequencies and give musical notes a dark quality, which went well with the often gloomy atmosphere. Under these acoustic conditions, the only kind of music possible was slow-moving and with no rapid modulations. Churches, on the other hand, were different in several important respects. Not only were they smaller on average, say 20,000 cubic metres, but they also had lots of wooden furnishings, choir lofts, pews, side altars, as well as panelling on the walls. All this tended to lower the reverberation time. When these churches were full, it was probably not much more than about 2 seconds. Furthermore, it shifted the region of maximum reverberation towards higher frequencies. In such an acoustic environment, a completely different kind of music flourished. The chamber music of the Baroque and early classical periods was, more often than not, performed in the palaces of the nobility. The rooms tended to be much smaller than the churches, volumes like 1,000 cubic metres. But their construction materials were similar, lots of plaster and wood panelling. Reverberation times were as short as 1 second, again favouring higher frequencies. Hence, the kind of acoustics they possessed were characterized by brightness, crispness, and clarity. And so was the music written to be played in them. In the last half of the 18th century, and all through the 19th, audiences for orchestral music increased, and of necessity, so did the size of the concert halls it was played in. The hall in which Mozart and Beethoven heard many of their own works, the Radautenzaal in Vienna, had a volume of just over 10,000 cubic metres and a reverberation time of 1.4 seconds. And this is the kind of music they wrote for it. The hall that was built in the same city nearly a century later, the Musikvereinsaal, which was one of those ones Ferg mentioned, had a volume of just over 15,000 cubic metres and a reverberation time of just over 2 seconds. Most of the halls around that time were of similar size, and I think there can be no doubt that the grand orchestral effects and lush harmonies, so characteristic of late Romantic music, owe a lot to the sheer size of these concert halls. Century music, on the other hand, has tended to retreat from this sound. And of course, pop music, which draws even bigger crowds, has a different sound again. So the requirements on modern concert halls are perhaps more diverse than they have ever been. In Australia, the building about which there has been most controversy, particularly while it was being built some 20 years ago, is the Sydney Opera House. It's a building, I must admit, I'm very fond of, and I couldn't resist the opportunity to go down and be shown over the concert hall by the manager, Lloyd Martin.
Lloyd, they're obviously setting up to something tonight. Can you tell us a bit about it, acoustically? What's its reverberation time, for example?
The reverberation of the concert hall is 2.1 seconds, which is a requirement for a symphony orchestra. In other words, the primary purpose of the hall is to play symphonic music, and most of the acoustic qualities of the hall were designed for that purpose.
Well, tell us about the actual features in the hall. I mean, the most obvious things are the donuts.
Well, the donuts, of course, are an acoustic feature, but they have no effect on the sound so far as the audience is concerned. They're lowered over the orchestra, and it provides the orchestra with a means of hearing themselves play.
Yeah.
If they weren't there, the sound would escape right to the ceiling and there would be some considerable delay before they would hear some of the other instruments in the orchestra. So the donuts are lowered and then they get immediate
sound. Let them play together.
Sound, yeah. Yes.
And the chairs?
Again, they're mainly timber. The seating part of it is wool. The purpose for that, purportedly, was to give the same reflected sound as if somebody was sitting in it. Now, I'm prepared to concede that if the hall was totally empty, you do not get the same sound as when it is full. But if you've got a house that is more than 50% full, then I think the idea of the woolen seating does help to give the sound equivalent of somebody sitting in it.
What do people think of it? That's the big question. Musicians, are they happy with it?
Well, my understanding is that it is considered to be one of the best halls acoustically in the world, particularly for the orchestra. I know that Jane Sutherland, to drop a name, Dame Jane considers it to be one of her favourite halls for singing in, one in which she prefers to sing, say, against the opera theatre, which is smaller, shorter reverberation time. And I think she feels that her singing doesn't have quite the same brilliance in the opera theatre as it does in the concert hall.
What about for speech? I mean, you hold speech days and things in here, don't you?
Well,
conventions.
When we amplify the sound, we can suitably modify it, but with particularly with pop concerts, long reverberation time works very badly for pop music, which is 100% amplified. The best place to hear it is in a dead studio because everything is amplified. For example, the Entertainment Centre, you hear a symphony orchestra playing there and you can barely hear it without amplification. Whereas
pop concerts sound
when
good.
The pop concerts are in there with all those huge mega amps of sound that they pump out, it's wonderful.
It sounds tremendous.
And it doesn't have a long reverberation time.
How much do you reckon people know about acoustics and how much do you think they're just swept away? Because it's a very beautiful place.
I guess acoustics are a bit like accounting. It's more of an art than a science.
Yes, I've learned that much.
I'd like to finish today's program by returning to the question I left dangling a little while back, the speed of light. At the same time as Sabine was doing his work in Boston, another American, Albert Michelson, from Chicago University, was carrying out a brilliant series of experiments to measure accurately just how fast light travels. The story of how this became for him a lifelong obsession is a fascinating tale in its own right, but not what I want to talk about right now. Ever since Young had shown that light was a wave, the big question was, when light travelled through a vacuum, in outer space for example, what was the medium that was waving? You see, the kind of experiments that Boyle did had shown that the properties of the medium are what determine the speed of the wave. But the evidence that came out of Michelson's experiments was irrefutable. There was no medium at all. So if light needs no medium, what determines how fast it moves? Why should there be a special speed at which nothing moves through nothing? The answer when it came involved a complete rethinking of what we mean when we measure speed, distance, and even time itself. These quantities are not absolute. They must always be thought of in relation to other quantities. Hence the name given to this new theory was relativity. Many workers were converging on these new ideas, but the man we usually associate with it, from the time he gave the world its first clear exposition in 1905, was Albert Einstein. He was born and educated in Germany, but did much of his early work in Switzerland and spent his last 30 years in America. He developed early a deep love of the violin, which he played all his life, passably well, I believe. He even got to play with top-ranking professionals like Isaac Stern, which is one of the perks, I suppose, of being a world-famous scientist. And it's an often repeated story that during one session, Stern remarked in exasperation, "The trouble with you, Albert, is you can't count." I often think it's ironical that Einstein, who made such a mark on the public consciousness because of the wisdom and gentleness he displayed in later life, should have been the one to turn physics upside down, and whose work would lead eventually to that ultimate horror, the atom bomb. For physics was changed beyond recognition by the publication of his paper on relativity. Above all, it was the old complacency that was lost, the belief that we knew it all. And the new mood that took its place was summed up by the British humorist J.C. Squire, who transformed that couplet of Pope's that I quoted to you in last program into a quatrain.
Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light. It did not last. The devil, crying, ho, let Einstein be, restored the status quo.
That was part four of Music and Physics by Dr. Ian Johnson, who lectures in physics at the University of Sydney. The producer of this six-part series is Mary Mackle. Next week, The Romance of Science with Faraday, Wagner and Max Planck. I'm Robin Williams.
Ah, Einstein. He always shakes up the party, doesn't he? Now, here's a little question for you. I've actually asked this before in the Science Show, but we're looking back, aren't we? Einstein loved playing the violin and did so often. He was usually accompanied by another giant in physics, Professor Max Born, who also got a Nobel Prize. A formidable pair. Now, the question is, who is Max Born's Australian musical granddaughter? Clue? She sometimes, like the professors, gets physical. And the answer is Olivia Newton-John. Yes, music and physics are intertwined everywhere you look. More next week as, just before the ABC is born, science is revolutionised and music with it.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.